Hello and welcome to Charity Chat. I'm your host, Emma Rylance. My pronouns are she and her. In this episode, I spoke to Jo Nicholson from Consider Creative. Jo co-authored a recent report entitled Illusion or Disillusion? How do LGBT plus people in the UK really feel about giving to charities? The 2021 census revealed that more than 1.75 million people in the UK identify as LGBT plus. But until now, very little has been done to understand the attitudes of this growing demographic towards charities and what motivates them to give. I chatted to Jo about the key findings and highlights of the research carried out by Consider. He shared what it reveals about how well charities are currently representing the LGBT plus community. Spoiler alert, we could definitely be doing better. And also the challenges to overcome and the opportunities to meaningfully engage with this diverse group of people and inspire new givers. This episode of Charity Chat has been brought to you by our platinum work sponsor, Work for Good. Work for Good is a fundraising platform helping businesses raise funds for charities through their sales. The platform makes the legal agreement needed for businesses to fundraise from sales quick and simple, saving charities time and resource and enabling them to raise more unrestricted income. Hop to www.workforgood.co.uk to learn more and book a free demo. Without further ado, here's Jo Nicholson. Good morning, Jo. Thank you so much for joining us and being the guinea pig for my very first ever Charity Chat podcast.
Great.
How are you doing this morning?
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, pleasure. Also, we're going to be chatting about the report that you co-authored, looking at how LGBT plus people in the UK really feel about giving to charities. But I'll start off by asking you to talk about yourself for a minute. Who are you and what do you do?
Sure, cool, thanks, Sarah. So I'm Jo. I'm an associate creative director at Consider. My pronouns are he, him. And I guess I'll just say a little bit about Consider for those who don't know. So Consider is a creative and strategy agency. And we've been working with charities since we were founded 20 years ago. I wasn't there 20 years ago. I've been here for about five and a bit years. Kind of multi-channel campaigns, fundraising propositions, strategy for entire income streams. Basically, charities, fundraising is our bread and butter. And fundraising is kind of my bread and butter too. It's all I've ever done in my career. It's all I've done kind of as a volunteer as well. So I've been a volunteer trustee for a National Homelessness Charity too. And I guess I've been fundraising like most fundraisers long before I got paid to do it. I'm thinking about all those kind of fundraising at university and at school. So it goes back a long way. But I'm really, really glad to be here and talking about this report.
Right. So how did that report come about and why do you consider feel that it was an important topic for you to explore?
Yeah, well, a few reasons, actually. I guess, firstly, it's something that we've been kind of really passionate about for a number of years. And it's kind of personal to me and a lot of our colleagues. It's kind of a lot of us are members of the LGBT community. But I guess more widely, that sense that the charity sector needs to do better in terms of inclusion and diversity, both to kind of do right by audiences, but also because it makes sense from a kind of income perspective, from a kind of from the perspective of charities achieving their goals. You know, the more people you can connect with, inspire, and represent genuinely, the more money you're going to raise, the stronger partnerships you're going to have, the more you're going to be able to do for your cause. So there's that kind of real need there, but I guess why now is another question. And this came at a really interesting time because I suppose we're really lucky to have the data from the UK census, the last census, so the 2021 census, which was released earlier in the year. And this is actually the first time that the country had demographic information on LGBT people across society. So we'd never had this included before. And this felt like a really great opportunity for us to kind of start thinking about the charity sector and how the charity sector can serve and work with the LGBT plus audience more effectively. And I guess there's not much out there. And we've been looking for, you know, those kind of insights and really interested in what the drag sector can do differently, but very little work has been done. I think NFP had done a smallish quant survey a couple of years ago, which is really interesting, but that is the kind of limit to the insights that we have. So we really didn't know what the charity sector could do for LGBT plus people. We don't really know what that audience, and we'll talk about this a bit more, but it's a kind of really diverse, not homogenous in any way group. So there's lots of complexity there, but there wasn't really that insight on why LGBT people decide to give to charity or have certain loyalties to different charities, what puts them off giving to certain charities. These were all mysterious questions. And those are the kind of questions we set out to answer.
And how did you end up being co-author? Was that something that was, yeah, you sort of led on or were handed?
I guess you've probably been able to tell that I'm really passionate about this. So it's something that kind of really, really drove and really wanted to make happen. But I can't sit here and kind of claim all the credit. Worked on this as well with Amy Neild. They are considered strategy director. So they are really plugged into this topic too. Again, they're a member of the community. And with, as a kind of organization, there's so much passion at Consider to do this. So yeah, as the kind of lead copywriter at the agency, it's kind of fell to me to be able to write it and put that report together. But it's really a kind of agency-wide thing.
Cool. And there is, I mean, I've read the report and there's a huge amount of information and insight in it. And you touched there that it's clearly, you can't just say that there's one size fits all for the LGBT plus community. There's like different age groups think differently, different groups that feel like differently. So there's way more than we'll manage to discuss today, and I would definitely encourage anyone listening to get hold of the report and have a read of it for themselves. But bearing in mind we can't cover everything, what were the sort of the highlights and key points that came out for you that really stood out when you were talking to different people?
Yeah, like you say, there's so much we could cover. I guess before we get into that, I might just share a little bit about the methodology of the report, just to give
a sense of
who we spoke to and where we got to. So this was a qualitative study. So I'm not a kind of strategist by training, but so I'm going to do my best to communicate this accurately. But yeah, it's a qual study. So there's deep dive interviews and really kind of, yeah, deep focuses on people's own experiences through those discussions. And we organised this in a way, so we spoke to LGBT people from across the UK and a real range of generations, locations and ethnicities, because I think that, like you said, Emma, it's not homogenous as a community. And I think that if you spoke to 10 people in Soho or 10 people in Brighton or 10 people from kind of Scotland who live more rurally, you'd have very different sense of people's experiences and how they engage with charity. So we wanted to make it really, really kind of diverse. And yeah, really interesting insights came out. I did a few of the interviews as well, and just so fascinating to speak to people. But yeah, some top line things. Well, I mean, the kind of most striking finding probably is that out of all of our participants, nobody could name a non-LGBT plus charity that's doing representation well. So that's taking your kind of Stonewalls or Mermaids or Terence Higgins out of the equation. Charities that work not exclusively with LGBT people, nobody thought that any of them were doing a good job representing the community. I guess for a lot of people listening, that's probably not going to come as a huge surprise, but it's a big challenge we feel to the charity sector that actually we could do a lot better. And what's really great is that our report actually over report, we kind of uncovered a few ways for charities to do that representation better. guess a really big insight that came from our conversations with participants actually was that representation really does lead to increased giving. So people said that they'd be much more likely to give to a charity that showed people like them in their comms. Visibility really does equal generosity. And that's just a really reassuring insight for us, because I think, you know, lots of people in the sector were really passionate about inclusion and representing people from all walks of life. But so often there's that kind of reaction, or I guess nervousness amongst a lot of people for understandable reasons. There's lots of nervousness about doing fundraising differently or changing how we communicate, that fear of losing income. And there's lots of complexity there, and I'd love to talk about that a bit more. But what came through really strongly was that for LGBT audiences, seeing themselves represented would make them give more. So I think that's a really, really exciting kind of insight, especially since, you know, looking forward into the future, society is changing and is becoming, we can all hope, more accepting. And looking at the younger generations, so kind of taking Gen Z, for example, Gen Z are the kind of least straight generation that we've got data on. And I think there's a Stonewall report that's just under 50%, so 47% of Gen Z at Stonewall interviewed, did a big kind of cross-nation study, and uncovered that, yeah, 47% of Gen Z young people don't identify as exclusively straight. So that could mean lots of things, but what it does tell us is that, you know, those younger generations are more open and there's more members of the LGBT plus community than ever before. So I think when you pair that to an insight like the one we've uncovered in this report, that visibility in charity comms makes people more generous, more likely to give, then there's something really interesting there that, you know, as time goes on, as the generations change, there is going to be much more appetite to see LGBT plus representation. It's important now, but it's going to become even more important as the years go on. And it is going to be a real, by doing representation properly over the next years and decades, charities are going to secure income. That's just what the insight's showing us. And that feels really exciting to me, because it's no longer a kind of, I think there's a bit of a potentially a bit of a perception around LGBT plus representation that sometimes it's a niche thing, or it's a niche kind of issue, or something that not all charities need to worry about. That's actually not the case, because of this generational shift, and because of the fact that, you know, representation equals equals giving and generosity. That shift is really important.
That's fascinating. So I'm very much from a legacy fundraising background. And I think when I first started, probably close to 20 years ago, you think about your traditional supporters, then you start thinking about the boomers. And I think maybe I feel like I've maybe got stuck there and forgotten to think that actually the next generation are coming up really fast. And as much as boomers are different to that older generation, like, yeah, things are just completely changing. Attitudes are so different that we can't just think, oh, we'll deal with it later. And it is, like you say, yeah, for any charity, regardless of your cause, it's potentially a massive part of your donor base.
Yeah, and that's really interesting actually that you mentioned baby boomers, because we did speak to a few as well as part of this research, and some really interesting insights in the legacy space. Asked all of our kind of baby boomer participants about gifts and wills and whether that's something that they thought about doing or are doing, and a real range, but some really interesting things came out. And I guess the most important, I think, is that for a lot of the kind of baby boomer LGBT people we spoke to, they've lived through a lot. And if you're in that generation, in that community, you've lived through AIDS crisis, also Section 28, and probably came of age in quite a hostile environment. Like the law changed significantly from kind of late 60s onwards. So it's kind of remarkable to think about that from where we stand now. But actually, people have lived through a lot. And I think there's this real sense of sort of precariousness or insecurity amongst LGBT plus baby boomers when it comes to gifts and wills, and wills in particular, because there's a sense of, you know, we aren't guaranteed, that it wasn't guaranteed in the past that our wishes would be followed after we died. You know, non-traditional inverted commas partnerships weren't always respected in society, and certainly not legally. So the kind of role of a will was really important to these baby boomer participants that we spoke to. They really felt that, you know, you need a will to ensure that the people you care about, maybe your chosen family or your partner if you're not married, or it's not a heterosexual partnership, it's really important to get your affairs in order. And that's something that, you know, we'd love to do more thinking about. And I think the sector as a whole can really work with that, because amongst LGBT baby boomers, there was this real knowledge that wills are important. And that's something that I think a lot of the time with your kind of more, with a more general audience, we're doing the education piece as part of legacy marketing, right? We're saying, yeah, Here's why it's important to have a will in the first place. We don't need to do that with those LGBT people of that age.
Yeah, you're right. You both get the feeling that people that age often think like, oh, it's fine because they're married, everything will just go to my space, I don't need a will. But yeah, so it's like, that's not the case anyway. But with this audience, maybe they're a bit more aware that it's important. And yeah, they could just take that next step and support charity as well. I thought it was really interesting. Obviously, one of the things that did strike me was that fact that none of the people that you conducted an in-depth interview with could name a non-LGBT charity that was doing well, which is not good. There's no way to pick like a positive spin on that. But reading the report, I didn't get to the end feeling sort of despondent and like I'd been beaten up as a charity who's getting it really, really wrong. I felt that there were just loads of insight, and I actually got to the end feeling, I suppose, inspired to do better and like it was possible to do better. So what are there any particular opportunities that you would highlight that came out that are opportunities that charities do have to do better at both representing and engaging with LGBT plus communities?
There's so many opportunities. Do you know what? It's actually a really good place to be in, the kind of baseline of, you know, no one in the LGBT plus community feels that, you know, those non-LGBT charities are doing well, because there's so much we can do and there's so many kind of easy wins. I could totally share your feeling that we're actually, you know, I feel really optimistic too. There's lots to say here, but definitely to start with, representation. And there's some nuances around this that we kind of explored in our research too. So I think there's the representation is really important to all of our participants, like I said, but it needs to not be tokenistic. And I guess that needs a bit of unpacking, because it's easy to say, oh, don't be tokenistic, and people can feel, well, what does that mean? I share that feeling sometimes, but to go into detail, this should help. It's really important to kind of be subtle and sort of incidental. So not so much focusing on, say, you know, what a bad example of tokenistic kind of marketing LGBT people is, you know, Pride Month comes around in June, London Pride, or, you know, or lots of the prides across the country are in June or around that time. And we think, okay, we're going to put some LGBT people in our social media, or maybe, you know, on a website for like that week. With no real context, no real sense of like why, that'd be fine. That's not great, because, you know, a lot of our participants said actually that just feels like we're just kind of being, you know, plastered on for Pride, and there's lots of cynicism around Pride and the kind of corporate involvement in Pride as well, and the kind of like Pride, there's lots of love about it, sure, but it's not the kind of be all and end all for when you're telling people's stories. And actually a lot of people we spoke to said that, you know, those little details of LGBT lives throughout the year in charity comms, they can be so much more powerful, and people will notice, because you're kind of on the lookout for people who look like you. And that's interesting, that's the experience I've had as well as a queer person. When you notice is the subtle kind of same-sex relationship in a charity ad or in photography, you do kind of, you notice. And it's something that's really powerful, I think, when it's peppered through the kind of comms calendar. There's another really great way to do this, which I think came through really strongly in our research, was showing how LGBT plus people are affected by the cause. So, for example, say you're fundraising for a hospice. Well, how does hospice care differ for LGBT plus couples, and maybe there are different barriers there. Maybe a same-sex couple might worry that there'll be judgment or kind of negative attitudes that they'll encounter when they receive care from a hospice. Maybe that's going on. So perhaps you can tell a story about how LGBT plus people have used your hospice and show them as one of the kind of the diversity of people that would go through your doors. Or another suggestion as well, which came through, was from a few of our participants, was like focusing on the LGBT people throughout all levels of your kind of programming. I think, for example, you know, lots of international charities do lots, and I can think of a few here who do lots of marketing around kind of their LGBT inclusiveness in the UK, and that's brilliant. But what's happening overseas? And lots of our participants are very aware that that laws or social acceptance for LGBT people is very different in lots of countries across the world. And actually, as an international charity, it's sort of conspicuously absent if you don't talk about LGBT people who might be service users or clients or however you phrase it, in countries that aren't the UK. So it's about being kind of really holistic. I think that came through in our research, like really showing not just kind of a few LGBT people at Pride Month, but how LGBT people use your services or engage with your work on all levels.
Yeah, we've definitely been guilty of bunging a rainbow logo up on during Pride Month and then sort of moving on to the next thing the next month.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting because we did a big bit of work with an organisation called Hassle Inclusion to make our website and all the digital process inclusive. And I really like the fact that they talked about it all as removing barriers and really to encourage us to go beyond making our services technically available to everyone. But that's very different from making people feel welcome when they come and like it is for them and that there aren't those other barriers, even though anyone could use our service if they're coming to our site and not seeing themselves or not. Yeah, we've done a lot of work around putting more guidance on Islamic wells up, for instance, because there's no reason someone couldn't have done it, but they might come and be like, well, there's nothing about me here. So the same with the other groups. Being accessible isn't quite enough. It's being really open to everyone.
Yeah. And there's a real kind of, I think this sort of flip side of any conversation around tokenism is the fear of backlash. And I think this is something that a lot of people, when we launched this report, we had a session with 50 or 60 people from the sector to talk about it. And lots of people said, you know, actually, I'm a fundraiser and I really want to do more. I really agree with all of these recommendations, but I'm worried about backlash. I'm worried about what my current supporters will say. I'm worried that a minority will, you know, criticize us on social media. I'm worried that I can't get sign off at a senior level, at a board level. And that came up a lot as well. And really interesting, there's a lot to talk about there. It's a big problem. I think that there is a real kind of need from the LGBT people we spoke to for charities to stick to their guns and to be really firm when faced with backlash, because I think that the sense of hurt and almost betrayal that this audience can feel when charities turn their back on them in the face of backlash, like that, it's almost better to do nothing and not even try to represent if the minute you're faced with backlash you say, okay, we'll change, because you're showing a kind of marginalized group that actually they don't matter as much. So that came through really strongly from our participants. But I guess practically, how do charities work around all of this? Something that came through for us was kind of community management. So being really kind of open on, say, comments on social media. And I think a lot of charities are doing this really well now. And just saying like that, this is why we're telling these stories. For example, LGBT people, they use our services like any other. So it's really important we tell their stories. This is just one reflection of the work that we do. Just being really honest, I think helps to kind of take supporters on a journey. And a fun thing I just wanted to say on that was that actually there's some really good examples of when charities have stood firm in the face of backlash and have really kind of benefited. So I think lots of people will be familiar with kind of RNLI's experience. So Fell fell ill of Nigel Farage and co around the channel, the small boats crossing the English Channel, and you know, Owen and I rescuing the really vulnerable people who were in that awful situation. And actually, they were really strong on that backlash and said, no, this is the right thing to do. This is what our charity exists to do. And their giving increased hugely. I think at one point it's 2,000% up, because people that, like, it's a huge amount, you know. And people thought, you know, I respect that, and they believe in that charity. And there was a third sector, a bit of research that hit the third sector press recently around negative headlines. If you saw that, it's more pronounced among the kind of younger audiences actually, but how negative headlines around a charity can actually help charities to fundraise.
Okay.
Because people think, well, I don't trust that newspaper, and actually I think what the charity is doing is right, so I'm going to donate to support them. So it's interesting, we kind of have this fear, oh no, if we do something wrong and we get in the press, or you know, we get backlash, we'll lose income. Actually, that's not the case, because people who really believe in your cause, you know, can actually have the opposite effect, and people feel kind of galvanized.
That is really interesting. But yeah, definitely is that fear. And like, from charities I've worked in, I can imagine a situation where it might be, let's say, the director of fundraising that signs something off, and then when there's a backlash, it's the chief exec that comes in and sort of is the one that then wants to backtrack on it. It's maybe getting that internal education and why it is you're doing it and why it is important to stay speaking about these things. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, you mentioned it before, but I was really struck about that statistic that I think it was 47% of Gen Z in the UK don't consider themselves exclusively straight. Because of Stonewall statistic. And I find that not funny, but because my experience of being at school in the 90s, I went to high school with maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people. And as far as I was aware, they were all straight. There was no discussion of it. There was nobody who was out as being gay or anything else. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if my university was much better. So I'm very conscious that I do worry about saying the wrong thing, because I'd like to think I'm more educated now, but still I do worry about putting my foot in it. And I imagine there's lots of people my kind of age in charge of fundraising teams. And I wonder, so what advice would you have for someone who, perhaps like me, who genuinely wants to do the right thing and to be more inclusive, to be better at representing different LGBT communities, but has that fear of getting it completely wrong and actually ending up offending the very people that they're trying to include and engage in and work with?
Mm. Yeah, it's really difficult. I kind of don't want to sit here as a kind of oracle, because I'm just from kind of one part of the community, and like lots of people there's real diversity. I think that like trying is better than not. And I think that's really, really important. I think comes through in our research that LGBT people were looking for that inclusion and representation. So it's so much more important to try. And I think just being really, really honest, I think some kind of suggestion or recommendation that we've made a lot is like going out, if you're working for a charity, and looking for those stories or people to kind of the LGBT people in your charity networks, like, you know, doing things like going out on social media and saying, look, we're really interested, but we really want to hear from the LGBT people who use our services. Like, please get in touch. We'd love to kind of speak to you or chat to you or however you want to run that. But just really being honest and reaching out. And then I think once you've got that network in place and you kind of know those people, you can kind of work with them to help you tell the stories right and to shape comms. And like, I think you kind of alluded to another issue here, which is charity workforces. And I think that we can only, I think, representation or kind of using inclusive language or doing storytelling right is so much easier when you have a workforce which is diverse as well. And I think that's a whole other kind of challenge, but bringing in people with that lived experience to kind of support and inform. It might be that, you know, it's about thinking maybe less hierarchically. We're in charities, and I think there's a lot of kind of, you know, things. I've worked in big charities myself, and there's a lot of kind of things go up the chain for sign off, and it can be difficult to convince people at the very top who maybe don't have that sort of lived experience or much knowledge and why speaking a certain way is right. But maybe it's about kind of breaking down those kind of structures a bit more and bringing in people who may be more junior, but have kind of come from a more diverse background, and inviting those perspectives on work. Kind of, yeah, I think challenging that kind of real sort of top-down approach is probably one of the ways forward. It's difficult, that's for sure. And I think no one's ever going to get it right. Language is changing and evolving at all times. And I think that it's important just to keep learning and keep trying.
Yeah, I thought there was a really nice quote that you include in the report. And I think it's from someone, one of the Gen Z people that you interviewed. And they are saying just that actually they're not looking for the perfect charity that's getting it all right, but they are looking for someone that's trying.
Yeah.
I think that's quite reassuring. It seems obvious when you say it that actually it's about actually talking to people and sort of reaching out. And yeah, I feel that's okay to be honest, that you're just looking for opinions and you do need advice from different people. Where can charities start? Are there any sort of quick wins, or just really things that just all charities should be doing as a kind of basis for getting going?
Yeah, well, I think it's that kind of representation is a really key place to start. I think like really evaluating all of your comms and the fundraising you're doing, and thinking about how can we bring LGBT+ people in, whether that is as beneficiaries and telling those stories, or whether it's kind of as people who are staff members or volunteers too, like looking to integrate those stories first is probably easier than kind of reforming all of the program work. But I do think that this came through really strongly, that kind of once program work is inclusive, then comms becomes really easy. I think as a kind of I'm a charity comms person, so I really understand that you can't make up what a charity is doing. You have to be led by the truth. And I think that does, once the programs are really inclusive, then comms can be really inclusive quite easily. So yeah, starting there. And I think also around kind of thinking about the kind of storytelling point, there is obviously loads of willing amongst the charity sector to be more inclusive. And I think that a lot of people will probably hear this and think, well, I want to do this anyway, like how do I start? And I think that from my perspective, as so I'm obviously in a creative agency, we work with charities to shape appeals and shape fundraising and shape their comms. I think that a lot of the challenges around representation come from like the pressure that's on fundraisers to get the job done. And I think that often, there'll be loads of fundraisers listening to this who feel, and you might feel, oh gosh, well, I really want to do this. I'm really passionate, but I've also got my budgets have been cut and I've got to deliver the same amount of work and I've got to deliver the same amount of income. And maybe there's some other, issues going on in my organization, which is going to make that difficult for me. I've been there so many times where it's like, this is kind of, it's not the lowest priority, but it feels impossible to make any headway as an individual fundraiser. And I think where I've seen it work really well with charities, so I worked with the British Heart Foundation on a range of their kind of entire legacy journey, and did a lot of comms with them over the kind of 3-year, 4-year period. And I saw it work really well where there's this complete buy-in into inclusion and representation across the organization. So we'd have meetings where we'd work on a kind of comms plan for a certain piece of a part of a journey for supporters. And we'd have everyone in the room. So kind of people from research, people from stories, fundraising, real kind of mix of stakeholders. And every single person was coming to the table thinking, how can we make these comms more inclusive? So everyone's asking that question. So your fundraisers aren't alone being like, oh, well, I need a case study for my appeal, but I need them to be X, Y, Z, and I need it now. And that's kind of story team goes, well, I don't have any, so that won't work. that's really challenging. But when you have a situation like at VHF, everyone's coming to the table thinking about it, you're much more likely to have those stories coming through. And I think it takes time, but it's about embedding that kind of culture almost of kind of, we are going to put those inclusive stories first at every stage, and everyone prioritizes it, and that means it kind of happens. I just want to say, you know, my sympathies to people who are really really passionate about this but feeling overwhelmed as fundraisers, because I've totally been there myself.
So it's familiar. I think one of the, going back to what you said at the beginning of just the fact that sort of demographics are changing, etc., I think one thing that comes through really strongly is that that it's not just a nice to have. And even if you, I think most charities would want to be more inclusive and better representation, just because that's the right thing to do. But also, it, from a fundraising point of view, it is a sensible thing to do. I think it came out in there that I think all of the people you spoke to said, regardless of age, that they were planning to leave a legacy. And it, like, really, yeah, just so many potential donors that it's not, I think it's maybe quite a good way of getting by. Is that it's not, we're not just being nice and doing the right thing, it's actually also from a sort of business perspective a sensible thing to do, to not exclude people who potentially would be your supporters.
And there's actually some really interesting insights around kind of how people from the LGBT plus community might give, and I kind of wanted to talk about this a bit. Something that came through really, it was really interesting actually, around direct to beneficiary giving. This is more pronounced among your kind of millennials, Gen Z audience, but still, that's really interesting because these people are going to grow up to be the main donor base of UK charities. So, and by direct to beneficiary giving, I kind of mean your kind of GoFundMes or crowdfunders. But there was this real appetite for that way of giving amongst this audience. Lots of reasons. I think it's like there's this real sense that giving for a lot of the people in this audience is an act of kind of solidarity. So less something which is, you know, not necessarily explicitly political, but like I am giving in solidarity with another marginalized community because I feel like I'm from one. And I think that's a really powerful motivator. You know, that's not something that, that's not a motivator that all donors share. That is quite unique. Sense of responsibility as well. So people felt, you know, if not me, who? And that was really, really powerful. But yeah, that kind of led to this appetite for direct to beneficiary giving. I think it's an interesting challenge to people working in the sector, and especially for kind of larger charities, because direct to beneficiary giving, you know, setting up a fundraiser for one specific person, that's never going to happen, or probably not going to happen for your large established charities. But it's something that we can definitely learn from. I think it's this, like, what's appealing about this way of giving? Well, donors can feel that they are, you know, supporting an underdog, someone who's definitely needs that solidarity. But there is that, you know, all of those classic things that we know make really strong fundraising, that sense of a connection between a specific person and a two-way conversation. There's also things like, you know, visible totalizers, you can see how your gift contributes to an overall target. Another really interesting thing is the kind of social currency that people can gain from direct beneficiary giving too. So you can kind of say, I've supported this person, so housing, they need housing, to take that as an example. I've helped them meet their goal, I've shared it on social media, I look good, I look like I care about this issue. I mean, that's, you know, it sounds quite cynical, but I think that is a motivator that came through for people. People would say, you know, I do get to show people what I believe in. And it's a question of belief, and it's a question of identity sometimes too. There's a big challenge there, I think, for the sector. How do we use that kind of giving more? Because it's very restricted. And also, you don't want to be seen as a large charity to be kind of eating up the direct beneficiary giving that is going on, because I think people give in that way because they feel there's no other option. It can be very urgent. Those GoFundMes that I've seen plenty, and they really hit hard because it feels that people have nowhere else to turn. But it's really interesting, I think, given that this is something that's very pronounced among your kind of Gen Z, younger millennial, LGBT plus people. Like I said, these audiences are only going to become more important to charities as time goes on. So now's the time to kind of understand those trends. And, you know, it may be the case that people stop giving in that way and start giving in a more traditional way. Like, we just don't know, do we?
Because yeah,
things could change. But yeah, something I'll be watching with a lot of interest personally, because that could be a completely different way of giving to charities.
But from a legacy perspective, I like hearing things like that, because just in general, it's, at the moment, it's very hard to get case studies because people don't want to talk about what they're doing, and they feel like it's very private, and they don't want to show off that they're donating. Mm. I really do hope that generally with the younger generation, people keep that willingness to actually like share with their peers, encourage other people to do it, and not be so sort of British and inverted commas about it. Maybe it's also a thing across the whole thing. I just scribbling that. I really like that, like, visibility equals generosity. I feel like that's like almost, if there was like one thing taking out of it, that's just like a really nice like mantra, actually, that it's that yeah, definitely translates into to people giving if they could really see themselves.
Totally. And you know, we haven't done the research on other kind of marginalized groups and how they give, but I think a strong hunch that applies across the board with all inclusion, and just, you know, if people are shown, no matter who they are, shown as in the kind of truth in comms, then that is going to help to inspire people to give. So I guess for us, this research is a real starting point, something which is not the final word, but what we hope is going to start a conversation in the sector, and yeah, give people some quick takeaways and ways to do better. And to improve what they do, but also to start thinking. And, you know, LGBT plus communities is really just the kind of starting point here. And there's lots to think about in terms of the intersections with other identities as well, and how charities can represent those. So, yeah, lots of work to be done, basically.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So I found the report fascinating and really thought-provoking. I think everyone should read it. So how could listeners most easily get hold of a copy of the report to have a look at themselves?
Yeah, oh, great. I'd really encourage everyone to read it too. So the report's available to download on our website, which is considercreative.co.uk. So yeah, you can pop onto our website and download your copy there. And it's a long report, but there's a very handy executive summary for you. So those key takeaways which we've gone through today are in a nice 2-page format. So you can take that and digest in a nice 10 minute session with maybe a cup of coffee, and get those key takeaways. You can also access our webinar recording too, so you can see the full discussion we had with Liz Tate from Gosh Charity, and Jake O'Dwyer at Stonewall, head of IG at Stonewall. So really interesting perspectives from the two of them on that report as well.
Yeah, there was, yeah, I listened to that, really, really interesting. Yeah, thank you again, and I look forward to hearing what happens next.
Great, okay, well, thank you.
Huge thank you to our guest, Joan Nicholson. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, please do get hold of a copy of the recent report. There's lots in there that we didn't have the chance to discuss, and it's a great starting point for anyone who wants to move beyond tokenism and authentically represent the LGBT plus community. Greater visibility equals greater generosity, and getting representation right opens up opportunities to meaningfully engage with a growing audience of potential givers. I find the report thought-provoking and challenging. I do want to be inclusive to everyone, but admit that I worry that I don't know enough about the LGBT plus community and will get it wrong and offend the very people I'm trying to include. It's clear from the research that doing nothing and burying your head in the sand isn't really an option, and charities need to be considering the needs of LGBT plus people at all levels of service provision. The good news is that the report identifies quick wins as well as deeper changes that charities can act on now. And talking to your own supporters is the best opportunity to find out what they need from you and what motivates them to give to your cause. I tried to remember this quote during the podcast and wanted to include it as a final bit of encouragement. Nobody's going to have it all right, and I'm not looking for the perfect charity, But if they're genuinely trying, then I will support them. That's from a trans man in Gen Z that was interviewed as part of the qualitative research. So thank you so much for listening to the end. I hope you enjoyed this episode and continuing to enjoy the podcast. We'd love to hear either way. Please do like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Plus, please do share with any colleagues or friends who might be interested. It's just left for me to thank our corporate sponsors. This episode of Charity Chat has been brought to you by our platinum sponsor, Work for Good. Work for Good is a fundraising platform helping businesses raise funds for charities through their sales. The platform makes the legal agreement needed for businesses to fundraise from sales quick and simple, saving charities time and resource and enabling them to raise more unrestricted income. Go to www.workforgood.co.uk to learn more and book a free demo. And a few final thank yous go to Giant Squid Audio Lab for sponsoring our podcast kit, to Magda Aksumit for our beautiful website, which you can check out at charitychat.org.uk, and to Forest of Fools for playing throughout the show and playing us out now. I'm Emma Rylance. It's been a pleasure to be involved with this podcast, and I hope to see you here again soon.